WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The Fox TV series Bones kicked off its eighth season this week. Behind that series are the 15 Temperance Brennan books on which the show is based. And behind all of this is Kathy Rikes. Outside of banking, Kathy Rikes is arguably Charlotte's most successful and possibly most influential citizen, a recognized and sought-after expert in the field of forensic anthropology who was able to capture and enhance the public's fascination with forensic crime-fighting techniques and achieve a whole new kind of success. She's been a guest on this program many times in the past, and we are pleased to welcome her back during this premiere week for Bones. And because the latest of her books was just recently released, the book is called Bones Are Forever, a fate I assume she wishes for the TV show as well.
That'd be nice. Yeah. I don't know if you could talk David and Emily into that. But
well, we'll just change casts.
Yeah.
Welcome back. Nice
Thank
to see you.
You
again. On your website, there is a plea for visitors to support a charitable cause by voting you the world's favorite crime writer. Aren't you already that?
Oh, I don't know about that. Now, I don't know which one that is. I think that's the Millions for a Morgue.
Okay.
And whichever writer, there are like seven of us, and whichever writer gets the most votes, they name the morgue. It's in Dundee, Scotland, for that writer. Yeah. How can you say no to something like that?
Well, I was thinking, how could you say yes to something?
Well, they need a morgue.
Do you
apparently.
Really want your name on a morgue?
Sure. In Scotland. Why not?
I remember when you were first on this program, I don't even know how many years ago that was, but I think it was for Deja Dead.
Yeah, we don't have to say how many years.
And I recall you approaching, just through your body language, approaching this conversation with some trepidation. At least that's what I was reading. And I think you were still teaching at UNC Charlotte and still mm-hmm. teaching up in Montreal, still working
right.
active cases for various legal departments here and in Canada. And now your world is completely different. Is it better?
It's different, yeah. I travel a lot more now than I did as a professor. I still do the triangle, Charlotte, Montreal, L.A. It's now a triangle instead of just back and forth. It's pretty busy doing two books a year and trying to read 22 scripts a year. Yeah, it's busy. And I'm writing one again this season.
Because you are the executive producer?
I'm just a producer. Yeah, and if you see our credits go by, they go by for like half an hour. Yeah. We have a lot of producers.
And I take it you're reading all the scripts because they want your forensic expertise.
Mainly, that's it. Yeah, I'll answer questions from the writers as they're developing. Each writer writes an individual episode. So I will answer questions about the science, you know, what kind of fractures do I put in the bones to show the guy was, I don't know, run over by a steamroller or something. And then I read the scripts to be sure they're scientifically accurate. It's not hard anymore because after seven seasons, they've really learned the terminology and they've really learned.
Do they have a staff, a corral, a stable of writers, or do they bring in writers throughout the season who maybe have never worked on that show but have worked on other series?
Both. We have a staff of full-time writers. I think we have seven. Mm-hmm. And then by union rules, I guess, every season two or three, have to be reserved for freelancers, for outsider writers.
So when somebody comes in freelance who may have not read your books or may have not watched the TV, how does that work? Do they watch every episode to get familiar with the characters and the backstory and how they treat each other?
They have to be familiar with the characters. And we have what are called arcing stories, backstory, but also the arcing stories that are going through that season. This season we're doing this Pallant serial killer thing. So they have to be very familiar with the style of the show. Each show has its own style. We work with six acts. You know, some shows work with four acts, and we have certain rules. There have to be X number of bone clues per scene or per act. I forget what it is.
Who developed that?
The executive producers, primarily.
And when you say bone clues, are they just that's just a clue for the whodunit part of the show?
Yeah, something involving the remains. And if you've seen the show, we've now done almost 150 episodes, and every single one opens with a body in some state of disrepair.
Mm-hmm.
So there have to be clues in every single case on the body.
I've often thought that it must be difficult for actors who come in to play a role in a series, who are not regulars. They come in and do 1 week because they're the victim or the friend of the victim or whatever it may be.
Right.
But it must be much harder for the writer who comes in for one episode.
Yeah, although that's a big deal. To get to write an episode of a hit TV show,
mm-hmm.
That's a big deal. Everybody in Hollywood has a spec script. People will sit and write an episode of Bones or an episode of NCIS or an episode of Grey's Anatomy, just hoping to be able to sell it.
So they just write it.
Mm-hmm. It's speculation. Yeah, spec scripts they're called. Yeah.
And their day job, they're a waiter at Chasen's
or whatever. Yeah, yeah.
Do they actually get seen by people? Do these scripts get seen?
I can't tell you what percentage gets seen, and I can't tell you what percentage actually get made.
Because if you write a spec script and you don't really know anybody on the show or in the production staff of the show,
hard.
I would think they would be reluctant to accept the script, because even if they don't like the episode, if something remotely similar to that appears
exactly.
on an episode, then they're liable to get sued
exactly.
for having read your script.
Yeah, mostly it's people in the business that, like assistants, people who are gophers and people who are assistants to the producers, they've all got a script in the works.
You write at least one script a year for the
right.
TV series. Is it difficult? Because we've talked about this in the past. We've talked about how the Temperance Brennan character in the book is a little older than the TV show Tempe. And is it difficult for you because you've got all these books under your belt and one in the works after this one right here that I'm holding in my hand, which is Bones Are Forever, to switch gears? Is it hard for you?
No, because writing a script is really different. First of all, you do it collectively. Once your story idea is accepted, you go into the writer's room and you do what's called breaking the story.
Mm-hmm.
And you do that with all the other writers and you brainstorm. You go in and the walls are covered with these terrifyingly empty erasable boards. And for our show, they're divided into six acts. And by the end of the week, you have hammered out. They're full. You've scribbled it on the boards together, your A story, your B story, your C story. So that's fun. That's really stimulating. It's very different than sitting alone at home behind my computer.
But the only person who's rejecting your story at home alone behind your computer is you.
Exactly.
But then you're in this room with other people who go, I don't think so.
Yeah, well, and then when you finally do agree as a group of writers, then you have to pitch the story to the executive producer
uh-huh.
who sits there going, and you don't know what he's thinking. And then
But these are your characters. This is your creation. Who made him God?
Yeah. Well, when I option the character, they're in charge. They're the boss.
Really?
Yeah.
And you like this?
I do. You know that going in. And the reason I went into this particular project, I'd had offers for other things, the feature films and things, is that they genuinely wanted my input. So when I hear authors whining about what they did with their character and they didn't like this, and it's because they weren't involved. And you know that. If you sign a contract that we're taking your character, we're optioning it or your story, you're out of here, well, then you can't really complain about what they do.
But was it like a very careful dance that you were doing at least initially, because you don't want to step on their toes, you've signed over the rights, but you kind of want to stay involved and they are relying on you for your scientific expertise. But if you are too assertive, they might say, we really don't need her. We get some other scientist.
Well, yeah. You can't step in and start telling them how to direct an episode. I'm not a director. I don't know how to do that. But I can tell them, I remember when we shot the pilot and they had these remains that were found at the bottom of a lake that had been there 2 years, and they had this, it really looked good, but bloated, like intestines and things. And I said, no, two years, you're not going to have any of that. So, they did remove it, but you can't start picking points on every little thing.
I can't remember the name of the actress who plays Tempe.
Emily Deschanel.
Emily Deschanel. I would think your presence might be particularly either instructive for her or intimidating, at least in the beginning for her, because not only are you the creator of the character that she's playing, but you are the person the character is based on.
Emily really liked having me around and wanted to know. Emily's like that. She wanted to do everything correct. She wanted to know, how do I reconstruct a skull from fragments? Or how do I do whatever it is she had to do? Such that we now have a full-time she's kind of an anthropologist who works as a consultant on the show.
Wow. When you were first on this show, again, back when Deja Dead and Death du Jour were, and I don't know which book we did first. I can't remember. I guess we did the first one first.
Probably,
which was the first
one? Deja Dead.
Yeah. I think I compared you, because of the Charlotte connection, to Patricia Cornwell, who was a crime writer. Mm-hmm. Who has written several books, and she moved on from here to Richmond, and she worked for The Observer at one point. You have eclipsed her. You have totally blown her out of the water.
I don't know. We'll see, because she's about to release a book, I believe. So we'll see.
Do you know each other?
I've never met her. Huh. And that's odd, because normally thriller writers, we're a fun group, and we like to get together. We spun off from the mystery writers and formed our own association, which immediately, international thriller writers, immediately, like overnight, became a massive success. So we get together. So we all, and we cross paths doing different literary events, and I've spent time just this last couple of weeks with Tess Gerritsen, for example, and I'll be with Ian Rankin in a couple of weeks. So we get to know each other, and she's one of the few that I've never met.
Do you has the television show, which has been extremely successful, 8 seasons of a TV show,
right,
means great success, not only now but down the road in
yes,
reruns,
forever.
But has it helped the sales of the book? Has it brought new readers to you?
Yeah, I think it has. It's hard to tell how that converts into actual sales numbers. But I would think it goes both ways. People who read my book said, okay, we're going to watch the show. Uh-huh. And people who watched the show, a certain percentage of them said, oh, I didn't know there were books. So they've started reading the books. But there is a segment of TV viewers who aren't really readers.
Yeah.
So it's hard to it has to have helped.
Well, the books sometimes mention, this one doesn't, interestingly enough. Yes, it does. The inspiration for the Fox TV series Bones. The book covers now say that, obviously for cross promotion. Do people assume in some cases that these are just extended retreads from the TV show, because they are not?
I don't know. They've never shared. I've never heard that comment. I do hear the comment a lot, well, the book TV is Tempe is very different from the TV Tempe.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and that's true.
How do your readers who found her through your books and who became fans of the books feel about it?
You know what? Initially, there was a little resistance because they expected it to be exactly the same.
Right.
And now they like the idea, because it's really more like a prequel. The TV Tempe is an earlier point in Tempe's life. She's in D.C. She's not very polished or sophisticated. She has very poor people skills. Whereas in my books, she's older. She's had certain life experiences, and she's become a bit more sophisticated. So I think once people get that, the backstory differs a little. But once people get that idea, they just think, okay, it's more of Tempe. I can see this version of Tempe and this version
of
Tempe.
Well, doesn't that, because the characters will age on the TV show, because the actors will age on the TV show over time. So does that leave the door open to them becoming these people we see in the book, the older versions of themselves down the road?
Yeah, it would be difficult because the backstory is different on television. But yeah, they have aged. I mean, they're 7 years older than when we started.
Kathy Reichs is our guest. Bones Are Forever is her latest book. She, of course, is the person responsible for the Bones TV series on Fox. We'll continue our conversation and meet her daughter, Carrie, in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Jamba Juice. Charlotte's now open in Founders Hall uptown, offering smoothies with up to 4 servings of real whole fruit, vitamins, and antioxidants, plus snacks and California flatbreads. Live fruitfully, tailsjambajuice.com. And by WTVI, presenting American Graduate Day, Saturday from 1 to 8 p.m., a live show spotlighting solutions to the nation's high school dropout crisis. Details about the broadcast and local efforts at WTVI.com. thesouth.org. But you know, the South is famous for its hospitality. In fact, one of the things people from out of town commented on during the DNC was our hospitality. But what does it really mean to be hospitable? We live in an angry, suspicious time where people on opposite sides are encouraged not to work together or compromise on anything at all. Is there no longer room for that kind of hospitality? We meet two charlatans being hospitable and focus on their lives tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, since the 1970s, there's been at least one hazing-related death every year on U.S. college campuses. Why the practice persists and what's being done to stop it.
That's the topic on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Kathy Reichs is our guest, but so is Carrie Reichs, who began her writing career in the world of, Kathy Reichs began her writing career in the world of academics, writing about scientific specialty that helped pave the way for fiction writing. She's also paved the way for her children in a manner of speaking, I suppose, if through nothing more than setting an example that you can make a living writing books. She's been writing a science fiction series with her son and her daughter, Carrie Reichs, who just joined us, has several books to her credit as well. She's been on this program in the past, and she joins us now. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
You brought your son, Declan, with you today.
I did. He's like a walking promotion for my third book, What You Wish For.
Yeah. He's adorable.
Thank you.
He's as cute as a button. He's 2 years old.
I'm a little biased, but I think he's pretty adorable. And yes, he's almost two.
And although he's out in the hallway making lots of noise, you say that if we put him on the air, he'll clam up.
He would think he was having a conversation with you with his mind.
Well, maybe we should put him on the air.
Hey, if conversation in here gets a little dull, it's probably not a bad idea.
Now, your books are very different from your mom's, and we had you on, I think, for both of the first two books. So describe what you, for listeners who don't know, describe what you write about in your books.
Okay. Well, like my mother, I'm a second career writer. I started out as a lawyer, but unlike my mother, I vowed to myself and promised everyone that my books wouldn't have any lawyers in them. So they're not legal thrillers. They're not lawyer books. And also because I tried to take a little of the sting out of having this unused law degree and master's, my books are comedies. So at a minimum, my parents can laugh at that if they're not laughing at the debt. I tend to write about main characters, mostly women, but not always, who are slightly unconventional. They're out of step with socially expected mores. So in my first book, The Best Day of Someone Else's Life, I write about a woman who is grappling with her feeling about the expectation that everyone should get married at a certain age. She's not as seduced with the Mary tale and the shiny, shiny white dress as maybe all of her friends and colleagues are.
Well, she's literally always the bridesmaid, never
always
the bride, and she doesn't care.
Exactly. And, you know, and growing up in Charlotte, I was often a bridesmaid at a very young age. And so there's some fun Charlotte peekbacks to some experiences that I've seen and tales that have been shared with me. So it's one of those truth is stranger than fiction type of books. Mm-hmm. My second book, Leaving Unknown, is about a woman who finds herself at a crossroads after college, recovering from something that a lot of young women haven't had to face in their life, in the loss of a friend to cancer, and looking at really the impact of a single cancer diagnosis on a community, and sort of survivor's guilt and how adolescent illness can impact, you know, youth that go on and how they grow up with their lives. And she takes a road trip in an epically unprepared manner in an ironic attempt to prove to her parents that she's not flighty and disorganized, and ends up broken down in a really small town full of quirky characters. My agent calls it Thelma and Louise meets Northern Exposure.
That's pretty funny stuff, then.
Yes, we try. And if I was going to brand the new book, I think I would call it, you know, Modern Family meets The New Normal meets CNN. It's called What You Wish For, and it's five tales of different people approaching family in unconventional ways. We've got a woman who's in her 40s facing the very familiar career versus family decision, but I've made it a little unfamiliar by making her unmarried. So she has to decide whether to do the donor route to have a child on her own. And then again, to take the familiar and make it unfamiliar, I put a male in the same position, but I make him straight.
Wyatt.
Exactly. So we look at Wyatt's struggle with our mixed messages about paternity in our society. We want our men to be attentive and involved in children, but if they're too involved, we become slightly uncomfortable. And why do we do that? And then there's a couple that I've taken from the headlines that's divorced with frozen embryos. She wants to use them. He wants to destroy them. So they're suing and looking.
And that's a case that's kind of out of the news.
Absolutely. This was a case I read about years ago in London. And the two things that struck me the most are how our science can outpace our laws, but also our social comfort levels. And we find ourselves in these gray situations we don't know how to address.
And that's the lawyer in you.
That's the lawyer in me. And then the human in me was very interested in how does a couple who were once so united in common purpose dissolve to the point where they're causing each other the most harm possible and hurt.
I'm curious about a couple of things about you personally. First of all, you have this legal background and you were a lawyer, and I know I work with lawyers, and some of them are really, really funny, and that seems odd to me because lawyers have to be so strict in their interpretation of things, and they have to go by the book, and they have to know all this stuff, and be able to do a lot of research. And how can you be funny in the face of that? When did you know you were?
It's like when someone says, "Say something funny," and you just freeze. I think a lot of lawyers are actually frustrated creative types who didn't know what to do out of high school. You know, I joke that I became a lawyer because no one was going to pay me to wear fabulous shoes and throw parties. And so I needed a job, and it's a reasonably challenging, interesting job where you get nice clients usually and smart colleagues. I'm definitely not one to say it's not the right career for me, but I think I, as many lawyers do, realized halfway through that I wanted a more creative calling. And so when the sabbatical presented itself, I decided to leap for it, and it turns out that sabbaticals agree with me.
I want people to listen to that very carefully. Management. I think they might agree with me too.
Exactly.
Although I'll never find that out. I'd like to also
miss you
know,
too much.
I'd also like to know where the idea came from in you to write about people who, as you say, are slightly out of step with the rest of society.
Well, I found myself approaching 40 and wanted a family very much and realized that I was not in a relationship. And, you know, we see this hotly debated on the pages of Atlantic magazine, whether women should settle early or whether they should, you know, have kids with or without men. And are we destroying the fabric of society? And I thought, well, you know, all I could do is pull one little string. So I did have a child on my own through a donor, and it's the best decision I've ever made. What's most interesting about it is not my story, but the fact that I get emails and phone calls weekly on an escalating level for the past several years of people saying to me, I'm thinking about this. I have a cousin. I have a friend. Can they contact you? And also the enormous tribe of people that I met once I crossed over into this single parenting by choice of people who, you know, have done this on their own or ended up on their own in ways unexpected. And I just started thinking a lot about what I want for my son. And what I would like for him is to grow up in a society where we don't have this idea that there is a right form of family or a best form of family. So he's not mourning this phantom identity that he should have had, but enjoying the life that he does.
Is that attitude generational or is it simply personal on your part?
I would like to think it's generational. This is stuff that we're starting to see percolate to the masses in shows like Modern Family and New Normal. Mm-hmm. We have IVF and surrogacy and biological donated materials. We have adoption, interracial couples, gay couples, single parents. This is changing. The modern family is not the cleavers. It's what you see through the cracks in the picket fence. And, you know, I think that I like to be a voice for what is a generation.
And yet the subtitle, and I think this is the subtitle of your book, What You Wish For, is All They Ever Wanted is Nothing Like They Expected.
I think that speaks to all parenthood, really.
Although it makes you want to read the book.
Well, thank you. If you want to know what it's like to take trapeze lessons, that's in there too.
Yeah, you took trapeze lessons to write this. Is this right? Now, the closest I've ever – you talked about the unbearable tightness of the harness.
The unbearable tightness of being?
Well, it's very good.
I like a little literary joke once in a while.
But you talked about the harness. You talked about the harness and how tight it was. And the closest I've ever come to that is when Kathy Rigby was in town doing Peter Pan. She let me put on her harness
That's
and fly,
fun.
Which was, I think, to this day, the biggest thrill of my life. Because, you know, I grew up, when I was 4 years old, I was watching Peter Pan as Mary Martin as Peter Pan, and I always wanted to fly. Well, I got to fly, and let me tell you, it hurts.
It hurts. And as it turns out, I have no natural aptitude for trapeze. So it was, I don't like failure, Mike, and it didn't go well.
Why did you feel you needed to do that? In order to write this character.
I suppose this goes back to the lawyer question. I am very big on verisimilitude. I want to write what's actually true. When I did Leaving Unknown, I drove cross-country 7 times to get the accuracy of that trip, and also because I liked it. But in What You Wish For, you know, I really tried to capture the feelings and the experiences of my characters in ways that are genuine. And that really is the trick with writing, is you take the familiar, you make it unfamiliar, you come up with a new concept, but you tell it in ways that people really get because it's genuine.
The first character in your book has an amazing name.
Dimple Bledsoe. But that's not really her name.
Yeah, but say her. I can't pronounce her name. I've never seen a Y with an accent over it. So give me Agnes's.
Agnes Bauksniaks.
And it's A-G-N-I.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And it's Latvian.
And her middle name is?
Dielma.
Dielma. I've often wondered where writers come up with the names of their characters. Your mom is still sitting here, so I'll bring both of you into this part of the conversation.
Obituaries.
I mean, where do you come up with a name like Agnes Dielma?
Bauksniaks.
Bauksniaks.
Well, as my mom said, it's true. Obituaries and cemeteries are great places. I'm a big fan of the baby name book. I spent a lot of time flipping through those. And in this case, I needed a Latvian name. And fortunately, we had just taken a family trip to Riga last summer, my father's birthplace, and had gone to a cemetery. So I got some great ideas there.
Really? I'm told, I could be wrong about this, that at least in movies and television, when a screenwriter comes up with a name, they have all phalanx of lawyers who goes through and makes sure that the name is not going to get them sued. Do writers of books have to go through the same gymnastics?
Not so much in books, I don't think. But when I wrote The Witch in the Wardrobe.
What's the difference?
You know, I don't know. When you write a script for TV, it has to be vetted at so many levels. Okay. And when I wrote The Witch in the Wardrobe, I used my neighbors' names because they thought that would be fun. And some of them made it through, and some of them got changed. Maybe because we'd used a similar name in a previous episode, or maybe for legal reasons. Wow. Who knows?
Interesting.
I love to pepper my books with friends' names, and they constantly will call and be like, oh, I just saw myself. But really, the interwebs are an amazing resource. So I'll Google main characters' names to make sure they don't actually belong to people.
Did you just say the interwebs?
The interwebs. It's where you can find everything.
The interwebs?
That's correct.
Okay. I feel like I'm in a time warp. You said that when you were writing about Agnes's anxieties about whether – she's an actress, by the way, right?
She is an actress.
Her anxieties about whether or not she really wanted to pull the trigger on this and become a single mom and do all this. That you wanted to get the anxieties, those feelings that she was having,
mm-hmm.
right. How do you do that? Are you going through the same things?
I certainly get asked which character I most identify with, and I think people expect the answer to be Agnes Dimple. But often the answer is really Wyatt, because I shifted from anxious non-mother to smug pregnancy during the course of writing this book. And so Wyatt has many anxieties about particularly all the stuff that a baby requires and becoming a single parent. And those are experiences I had. But one of the things about Dimple that I felt was critical was to capture that stark fear that she has of not having children. And, you know, really it's sort of digging deep, trying to remember before smug pregnancy what it felt like, because I want to not only do justice to how difficult a decision that is, I try to want to diminish some of the glib judgments that are made about, you know, women who do this, that's a willy-nilly choice that's done with no consideration of the impact on the child or others or the very fabric of society. These are difficult, difficult decisions for people.
These things that you write about, these people who are not trotting the same old path as the average person, who are taking a different tact on life, is this a niche in literature that you've carved out for yourself, or is it becoming a more crowded field because of people like you and because people, as you say, are not living traditional lives like we lived in the 50s and 40s and 30s?
I would love to make it my niche. You know, I would not be so bold as to claim it yet. I think that what I describe it as is sort of page 8 writing. I try to take things that are buried in the back pages, that are barely germinated, stories and current events and catch them before they hit front page news. So when I started writing about this, things like embryo personhood or these legal issues related to frozen embryos hadn't really percolated to national conversation. And as we see now with the election cycle, it's everywhere. So I'm always sort of thinking about what is the uncomfortable place that we're going to find ourselves with the few outliers that are forging down that path of family interaction, social choices of the future. So where are we going to be struggling in the next 5 years when this has become more of a settled issue? And that's what I want to write about next.
Who are your readers? Are they people who hunger for this, for finding somebody in a book that looks like them, who's going through what they're going through, who've had the thoughts that they've had in their heads? Is that who the readers are? Or are you finding that your readers are people who are struggling with members of their family who are making these decisions and they're just trying to figure all this out?
My readers are people who like characters that feel so real that after you've closed the back cover, you think that they're still in your living room. If you really want the dialogue and the genuineness of a character that's breathing off the page and telling their story, whatever it is, even if it's something you completely have never even contemplated, like trapeze or single parenthood or non-parenthood, if you want to hear them go through that experience in a funny way because they're believable, that's my characters.
You know, you, in this book, as you said, you're following five different people, not with the same story, not even with necessarily similar stories, but they're struggling with things not unlike each other. And you've built very detailed lives for all these people. There's when Wyatt is on the bus on his way to school, and I think it's a day when you're being encouraged not to use your car.
Right.
So he's on this bus, and he's sitting next to this woman who's reading not Oedipus, but one of those other classical pieces.
It was
of
a classic. It was not a vampire.
Chaucer.
Book.
He was reading Chaucer. she was reading Chaucer, and he wants to comment on it, but he doesn't because he just doesn't want to overstep the bounds of familiarity. He talks about that, and then he gets off the bus and he says has a short little 2-sentence conversation with this kid who got to school on his skateboard. I mean, that kind of stuff. Where does that come from? That is so the minutia of the detail makes it very real. And you don't linger on it, so it's not hard to deal with. But where does that come from?
Well, not to suggest any level of mental illness, but, you know, these characters are very real to me. They live in my head, and their voices are so clear. And I think that's the essence to writing a character that breathes for your readers, because they've never met Wyatt. And so to be able to capture his whole life in just a sentence, I need to know him thoroughly. And he's, you know, one of my favorite characters I've ever written. He's such a genuinely nice person who's getting caught in some really challenging situations and trying to get out of it with grace, but also a level of assertion.
There's a P.S. section in your book in which you talk about that when you write, you listen to music. Mm-hmm. And in this case, for this book, What You Wish For, you have these five different characters and you had five different playlists for the characters. What dictated the playlist? And did the playlist that you were listening to while you were writing their story inform the story in any way?
Well, it would inform my approach to the story, and often the things that surprise me are the organic ones that come from the mood set by the music. So I always say that I don't necessarily know what I'm going to write each day. I know what I'm writing beginning to end. So if I was listening to some gloomy music, it might be a sad scene. If I was listening to happy music, it would be a trapeze scene.
But the music that you're listening to is very specific to the
yes.
character. We have to stop, and I have to say goodbye to you because you're on your way to Baltimore.
On my way to Baltimore.
Carrie Reichs, What You Wish For, a novel. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Healthy Home Market, a family-owned, locally grown natural food store serving the community since 1979, now with 5 area locations, online at healthyhomemkt.com. And the Southern Women Show, celebrating 30 years, shopping, health advice, beauty tips, and fashion shows today through Sunday, the Park Expo and Conference Center. Tickets at Harris Teeter or southernwomenshow.com. Since the 1970s, there have been at least one hazing-related death every year on U.S. college campuses. Why the practice persists and what is being done to stop it? That's the topic of the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock in 20 minutes. If you'd like to join our conversation, Now's the time. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back with Kathy Reinks.
You know, you get attached, but it is still just a thing. And we started thinking, well, we could trade it in, but we probably wouldn't get a whole lot of money for it. And we thought, who deserves this vehicle? And we said, hey, public radio deserves this vehicle. My name is Bruce Yelton, and I donated my GMC Safari to public radio.
Learn more at WFAE.org, and thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're sitting in our Spirit Square studio today with Kathy Reinks. Her latest book is called Bones Are Forever. Of course, the TV show upon which, the TV show Bones is based on the books. It started its eighth season on Monday night on the Fox Network. We just had Carrie Reinks, her daughter, on. Her latest book is called What You Wish For. We had to let her go early because she has a book signing in Baltimore tonight at 7 o'clock, and she's driving from here to there with two cats.
A baby and a Mini Cooper.
And a Mini Cooper.
And all the truck that goes with a baby.
Wow.
Yes.
I wouldn't want to be her today.
Yeah.
Or Declan today. As you were sitting there listening to this very sophisticated, very smart, very funny, very accomplished woman who is your daughter.
Yes.
What goes through mom's head?
Well, the first thing that went through my head when you said she was 40 is that I gave birth to her when I was 12. So I want to make that clear to everyone listening.
Does it surprise you either your success or her success?
No, she's smart. She's very smart, and her books are hilarious. She
yes, they
deals
are.
With some serious topics, but the books are actually hilarious.
My younger producer, Aaron Sutton, just came over to me in the break, and she said, you know, interwebs is a joke among those who know.
It's kind of like Chuck Norris. There's this whole Chuck Norris culture out there. Who knew?
Yeah, exactly. Who knew? Is this fiction writing thing for you something – is it anything like what you thought going into it?
The writing –
did it ever occur to you that it would be like this?
Well, the writing is, you know, I did have this image of sitting home. I could stay home and stay in my jammies all day if I wanted to and sit at my computer. That part, yeah, that's pretty much how it's all the promotion that you don't think about that when you write a book, that you're going to go on tours. Last year I did 5 separate tours, and you have to have a presentation. I don't know what authors do and I think people become writers because they are a bit reclusive and they don't like to be up in a public forum and speaking to people. I don't know how they do that, writers that are uncomfortable with that, because it is expected. You go to signings and you do public talks and you travel around to bookstores. And
you know, it's interesting because it always fascinates me that writers, even when they're unknown, will go to a bookstore for signings. I mean, how many people, unless you're Kathy Reinks or Clive Cussler.
I just spent some time with Clive.
Well, who shows up?
I mean, yeah, that can be very demoralizing.
Yes,
you
I would
go
think
to
it'd
the
be terribly
bookstore,
demoralizing.
5 people are there and 4 of them are your sisters.
And we spend a lot of time on talk shows like this talking to authors about stuff they made up. It's not real. It's stuff they made up. But we don't do that necessarily as much with people who write television, people who write movies, people who are producers of television and movies. We just don't. What is it about books? Is it because books are literary and we feel good about talking about things that are smarter than television?
Maybe, but it is very difficult for fiction authors to get media. Generally, TV shows and radio shows want to talk to nonfiction authors because they have a subject matter beyond their book, I guess, that you can draw upon.
Well, it's real. But then you live in both worlds.
I do, yeah.
And you still work, do you not, as a forensic anthropologist? Not as much as you did, because God knows you don't have the time.
Yeah, I do cases in Quebec still for the lab up there. And then I will do selective cases, something that appeals to me for a particular issue or element.
And do you do that because you need to stay current for the sake of the books and the TV show, or do you do that because you really enjoy doing it? It's what brought you into this life.
I do it because I really enjoy doing it, and I feel a loyalty to the lab. I've worked there for 20 years. But I do think the byproduct is that it keeps me more current. And, you know, if I'm in the autopsy room or at a crime scene, it does keep me current on the details of what goes on in those contexts.
Mm-hmm. You get very detailed. We've talked about this in the past. Very detailed about some very gruesome things. This new book opens up with the discovery of a baby, a tiny little baby, under a sink in a nasty bathroom in a terrible rental unit someplace in Canada. And then shortly thereafter, the discovery of two other infant corpses that are in various states of mummification. Something that is not as gruesome, perhaps, as crawling through the sewer or the septic tank that happened in another.
It was a septic tank.
Well, it was disgusting, but but this is something that you have personally done, and I know that you've worked with these corpses in various states of decay. And it's very gruesome in these books. Is the TV show this gruesome?
Well, I think our opening scene, our teaser at the beginning is, because every week we have a body that's, you know, burned, mutilated, mummified.
You can't go into the great detail. All you can do is show it. You can't go into the great detail of how long it's been dead because of the number of the bugs crawling through a body or, you know, what the gestation period of a maggot is. You can't go into that.
Well, that's kind of Hodgins. You know, Hodgins will do that. He'll say it's this remote beetle from, you know, Patagonia or something based on X, Y, and Z. But you're right. This book opens. It was difficult to write the beginning chapters of this book, and I'm sure it's difficult to read them.
Mm-hmm.
I was simultaneously working on three child homicide cases when I started Bones Are Forever. One is an 11-month-old. One was a 2-year-old, and one was a 10-year-old who'd gone missing about 12 years ago, and finally her little skeleton turned up. So the idea of the death of truly innocent victims was very much on my mind. These are the hardest cases for me to work on and remain emotionally detached. And these are victims that in no way brought this on themselves. They didn't put themselves at risk in any way. They just were truly vulnerable, innocent victims.
Right.
So that was at the forefront. So I try to bring out through the character, through Temperance, some of the feelings that I have and that my colleagues have, I'm sure, when we're working on that kind of case.
Yeah, after you finished one of the examinations of, I think it was the first infant, I can't remember, and you're wheeling that infant back into the morgue, you're saying goodbye to it, essentially.
Well, she's saying goodbye, and I'll take care of you. Yeah. I will make sure that, you know, justice is done.
Your character, Temperance Brennan, gets involved, and she gets involved in more deeply than I would bet Kathy Reichs has ever gotten involved. I could be wrong, but she gets involved. But if she didn't, that would be the end of the story.
Yeah, it would be boring if the character just went to the crime scene and recovered the body and then just went to the lab.
So is she doing things that you wish you could have done or could do?
Yeah, to some extent. I don't know where I'd have time, but I do not go with the investigating officer questioning witnesses and, you know, returning to the scene. I work with the homicide detectives if it's a homicide case, but mainly I interact because they come to my lab and they want a report or they're giving me an update.
I think I'm right. You've written 15 books in this series.
In the Temperance Brennan series,
yes. You have what, 17, 18, 19 books in total, but in this, maybe more.
Well, not fiction? Yeah, just counting fiction, there are two Tori Brennan books out.
Yes.
And the third one's coming out in March.
The two books about Tori Brennan are Virals and Seizure. And she's young, and she is the cousin, the nephew, the niece of?
She's the great niece. It took us a long time to figure out the age, how this would work. She's the great niece of Temperance Brennan. So she's Tori Brennan, and she lives in Charleston. So those books are set in Charleston, and she and her teenage friends, who are all boys, are kind of science geeks. They're mm-hmm. not the cool kids at school. So they use science, and they also, we learn about it in the first book, what happens to them, but something happens to them, and they acquire some special abilities. So they use those abilities and science to solve crimes and cold cases.
So is there a Disney Channel TV series in this?
We're in discussions.
I'll bet you are. Because that seems like a natural fit.
Yeah, yeah.
Or even MTV, maybe. I don't know.
Well, we wrote the series. My son proposed it, and he and I write it together because a lot of kids watch Bones. And there's an interest in forensic science among kids.
Now, your son is Brendan.
Brendan, yeah, another non-practicing attorney.
And and we've had him on the program, too. I don't think you could make it that day. I think we had him on solo. And you write these novels together for young people.
Right.
Does he do most of the writing? Do you do equal amounts of the writing? How does the process work?
We do a very detailed outline, which I don't do for the Temperance Brennan books. Our outline for Tori Brennan will be 10 pages, single space, chapter by chapter. And then he takes parts, and I take parts, and then we periodically meet and discuss our creative differences. And I edit it. He gives me his parts, and I combine everything, and then I very heavy-handedly, according to him, destroy his work and edit it. And we do that for, you know, every – I think the book is in four sections, so each section we do that. And then we will cloister ourselves at the end of the process with the whole manuscript for about 3 days and discuss changes or not making changes.
I take it from the expression on your face, the tone of your voice, and what you're saying about this process is that you seem to take the lead on this. Does he ever win?
Occasionally, he will argue a point, and occasionally I will say, okay, maybe that word was just as good as the word I substituted.
Uh-huh.
But generally, he does it my way.
You outline these books. Why? Did that come from sitting in the writers' meetings for the television show and learning that process, that outlining process?
Or? I think it's more because it's a collaborative effort. There are two people working on it, and we really need to know where we're going, exactly where we're going and how we're getting there.
Does it follow the outline, or does the story sometimes take on a life of its own beyond the outline?
No, it follows the outline much more so than the Temperance Brennan books. Those are more of a free flow that I do. But with the Tori Brennan books, we pretty much have it struck because they're just as complicated as the Temperance Brennan books. They're big, honking books. They're thicker than a lot of the Temperance Brennan books. The difference is that the characters are younger, mm-hmm. so the dialogue is different. They're not talking like crusty old homicide detectives. And the social concerns are different.
Now, it's a screenplay for an hour-long television show, which is what? How many minutes is an hour-long television show? 47?
Yeah, something like that, 48.
48 minutes is obviously considerably shorter than a book.
Yes, I was stunned. The first script I got, you see it in movies and you get this big, thick thing. It was 60 pages. It's about a page a minute.
Wow. And it takes how long to shoot a page?
Each episode, yeah. Each episode is about a nine-day shoot.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how far ahead are they? The first episode aired Monday. How many episodes are
already? Yeah, I think I just got the sixth episode script yesterday.
And so how long does it take to write an episode versus a book?
The last one, I pitched the story. Let me think. Went out to the writer's room and we broke the story. That took a week in November. And then you go back home and you write a very detailed outline. And then when that's accepted, then you are sent to script. And I think I did that in December and then we shot in March.
Are you careful not to duplicate stories that have been told in the book or things that have happened in books that you might want to be tempted to put in the TV show? Or does it matter? Do you sometimes take things out of the books that have happened and stick them in the show and vice versa?
Yeah, not so much. I'm not writing them, don't forget. I only write an episode here and there.
Okay.
And none of the episodes so far has been based on a specific book. It was the character that was optioned.
Your first books in this series were Déjà Dead, Death du Jour, Deadly Decisions, or Deadly Décision,
yes.
Fatal Voyage, Grave Secrets, then Bare Bones and Monday Morning, MOURNING.
Right.
Then came Crossbones, Break No Bones, Bones to Ashes, Devil Bones, 206 Bones, Spider Bones, Flash and Bones, and the new one, Bones Are Forever. is the shift to having bones in the title of every book because of the TV series.
Yeah, you notice that? Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
How did bones become the title of the TV show? Because a forensic anthropologist doesn't just work with bones. You go through a lot of soft tissue analysis.
But it's to get down to the bones. Oh. Ultimately, that's the expertise, is the bones. Now, you may get your bones encased in burned flesh or decomposed flesh or mummified flesh, but you really have to remove that to get down to the bones to do your expertise. The title was a working title for a long time, which the probably the executive producers came up with, and then, of course, it's batted around between the studio, the network, the producers. So for a long time, it was just a working title, and we didn't really think we'd stay with it. Mm-hmm. And then the decision was made, not by me, to stay with it.
What's the next book title?
The one I'm working on after Bones Are Forever. I don't have a title yet.
Oh.
But I went on a USO tour last fall to Afghanistan and Kyrgyzstan. So guess where Tempe will be going in book 17?
Afghanistan.
16.
But this is interesting to me because, you know, we hear of comedians and starlets going on USO tours. What does a book author do on a USO tour?
There were five of us invited by the Pentagon, the USO, through the International Thriller Writers. Mm-hmm. It was Clive Cussler, mm-hmm. was one of the others who went. Sandra Brown, Mark Bowden, who wrote Black Hawk Down. So we spent a lot of time riding in Black Hawk helicopters. So sitting there next to Mark Bowden is quite an experience. Yeah. I kept saying, Mark, are we okay here?
Was it a scary thing? Because it's a dangerous place to be.
It's an anxious thing. When you're flying in these helicopters and you're flying through these mountain valleys and you know that the range of the rockets that the insurgents could be firing up, you're within the range.
Right.
We also did take incoming rounds, incoming rockets, I guess. The first night we got there, we all had to get up and get into bunkers. So, yeah, it was. You weren't calm the whole... You were calm, but you weren't...
And you weren't staying at the Afghanistan Hilton, I take it.
We were not. We were right on base.
Kathy Reich's new book is called Bones Are Forever. It takes place mostly in Canada, which is the focus. She shifts back and forth between Montreal and Charlotte, although the next one will be in Afghanistan. And, of course, it's the inspiration for the TV series Bones, now in its eighth season on Fox. Carrie Reich's our guest earlier, What You Wish For, a novel. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you.